a Rayo Original Podcast.
Joe.
I'm a bit starstruck because I've listened to this podcast. Mm-hmm. I'm intimidated by you and frightened.
It's time to reveal your biological age. Joe, chronologically, you are 37 years old. Your biological age is... 30. Joe Lysett, welcome to What's My Age Again?
Would you like
to hear your intro read in front of you?
I would love that.
Something that I've started doing.
Could I read my own intro?
Yes, please.
Hello and welcome to What's My Age Again, the only podcast where our guests... Isn't it?
Yeah, it's...
The only podcast where we ask our guests to give us their blood. Today's guest is a stand-up legend, political prankster, incredible artiste, and cherished father and partner. Some of that is true.
Okay.
From cutting his comedy teeth in the north to dazzling our screens with his quick wit and cunning complaints letters, the artist formerly known as Hugo Boss has cemented himself as one of the most loved comedians to come out of the UK. All bang on. That is bang on. Yeah. If he's not busy filming Travel Man, which is currently on the shelf, not decommissioned. They don't decommission things now. They just leave it on the shelf for hundreds of years.
They don't have the budget to decommission anything.
And Late Night Lysett, also on the shelf. Then you can find him behind his easel painting some of the most established figures of our time. From Lisa Scott Lee to Liz Truss, he's covered the wheat and the chaff. That's offensive. But it's not all been plain sailing. He suffered from loss, anxiety, and going through therapy. All of that correct. Has sticking it to the man been at the cost of his health? Has a career in the public eye taken a toll on his privacy life? All will be revealed with our groundbreaking test measuring inflammation to a cellular level. What a sentence.
I know.
Please welcome to the show, Julian Clary.
Do you like that intro?
I do like that intro, yeah.
It's dramatic.
Did you enjoy the reading?
I loved, you're the first guest who has ever delivered their own intro. Mm. And of course you would. I think
yes,
it's better coming from you.
Yeah. There's an arrogance to that, isn't there, that is fitting, I think.
Well, you dismissed a lot of the things as being not true. Like, how cherished are you as a father and partner? Do you think that you could stand to be more cherished?
Oh, always. Mm-hmm. I said years ago that I want all living people, and dead actually, to adore me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's still the goal.
Yeah.
I heard once that Rose West listens to Radio 4. And I thought, I'm on Radio 4. And then I was like, do I want Rose West to like me or not? I was sort of confused about. And I think I do.
Yeah.
Because I think it'd be useful if I had to negotiate, you know, something with Rose West. What a world that would be.
You wouldn't want a murderer to not like you.
Yeah. Yeah,
that's exactly, where your problems exactly. begin.
Yeah. So I'd want her to be like, well, we'll leave him. Oh. So, yeah, I do think I'm cherished and... I feel very loved at the moment, and I feel in a sort of golden era of my life.
Yeah.
But I'm so aware of the sort of impermanence of it at the moment that, like, I get very emotional when the lovely things are happening because I sort of think, oh, this is, like, my son at the minute is so fun and so funny and adorable and fascinating. But I know he's going to evolve into his sort of next Pokemon stage and... I'll want to go back to the Charmander and not the Charizard, you know, whatever the analogy is. So I'm sort of really holding on to it all and trying to be very present because it's just a lovely age. He's 16 months and...
It does get better still before it gets worse. I will tell you that.
Okay, great.
So you've got even better times to come for a little while and then...
When's the sort of peak?
I'll reveal that to you under the cloche. I think they're kids until 9.
Yeah.
But I don't know about boys. It might be different. All the young boys that I know, and there are many, there are many, many adult women can be friends with boys.
Yeah.
And nothing goes weird. We're not interested in any deviousness with what we could just have kids as friends. I can stop kids on the street. I could stop young girls on the street and be like, can I get your number? Do you want to babysit for me? Like, where do you live?
Yeah.
And it's fine.
Yeah.
I can buy girls drinks. Little boys that I know, they do get very, almost like nerdy at a certain age. All of the ones that I know, they get like goony.
Yes.
Kind of 6, 7, 8. And Fred, my son, is 4.5.
Right.
And he's revealed a lot about men to me. I think that as just as a study of one, I think growing a small man from scratch, like they are more sensitive than I thought, but he's into like just dweeby things now. Like, and he likes to fight and he's very physical.
Oh yeah. This is one thing that's been unearthed in me.
Yeah.
I love fighting my child.
Okay.
And he, in a safe environment.
I know.
On the bed, bit of wrestling, a bit of, you know, slapping each other, all of that.
Do you think it keeps you young?
100%. I remember watching a couple of friends of mine, adult men, one of them, Ivo Graham, who's, you know, an Oxbridge graduate, wrestling in my living room. And I thought, I haven't wrestled for a long time. I don't know when I last wrestled. And they were having such a lovely time and getting such a dopamine hit from it. And I thought, there is a sort of, I don't know, a kind of animalistic thing in men that I have found with him, where I just want to wrestle him on the bed before I put him down for his 7 p.m. bedtime.
You got to fight him. And Fred will say to Bobby, they'll have scheduled fights.
Yeah.
He'll be like, tonight, I'm going to kick your ass. 6 p.m.
Yeah.
Meet me in the cinema.
What is it?
And they fight. Well, Jordan Peterson, a Canadian that I hate to...
A dear friend.
I hate to quote him in front of you. He had a whole thing about it, about how important it is for
he's
dads.
Got a lot of things, Jordan Peterson.
This is the thing with the guys, the spicy guys, is that they say a few really smart things, and then there's the horrible stuff where you have to go, oh, I need to throw all of this away. Louis C.K., before he took his dick out at work.
Yeah.
He had so many great jokes. Yeah. And Jordan Peterson's isolated theories on like dads fighting their young.
Yeah. A stopped clock is right twice a day, isn't it, Catherine?
Thank you. So on the subject of your son.
Yes.
You are a prankster, an activist, so many things aforementioned in the intro that you delivered brilliantly. A lot of people thought when he was born that it was a prank. Why do you think that is?
Well, because I've done so many pranks. And also I think lots of people just think of me, most of the public sort of have a bit of an idea of me, I imagine, but haven't maybe watched my stand-up, don't know a lot about me, and so presumed I was gay. And so the idea that I had a baby with a woman was very confusing to them. And I think there was a bit of press interest, one, because I'm on the telly, but also because I think they were sort of like, oh, is this like an accident or... is he still doing gay stuff on the side? I think there was sort of an intrigue in that regard. And then when it was sort of apparent that I was just wandering around Birmingham with my partner and child, it became very boring to them and we've not been bothered since. But I think lots of people thought, oh, this will be a prank about, you know, Calpol or something. And
sponsored by
it was just, me and my partner, Denise, decided we wanted to have a baby and we did, because I'm incredibly fertile.
Yes.
God, I'm fertile.
It didn't take many tries.
Well, you know, I didn't even try. And here we are.
Didn't think you could get pregnant the way you do it.
I didn't think about it. I just did it. And here we are.
Was it a surprise?
It wasn't a surprise. No, we started talking about it. And then we just got so curious about it. Because I always said that I didn't think I'd ever have kids, but that I would, if one happened by accident, I'd have a really good go at it. And then I think being in a sort of stable, loving relationship, suddenly I was like, oh, it would be fun to have a go at this. And so then once we'd started talking about it, it became sort of an inevitability, really.
Yeah.
And the Punisher is now 16 months old.
The Punisher.
That's what I call him.
Does he win any of the fights?
Oh, all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, he sort of... and he's always found it really funny, things hitting me in the face.
Mm-hmm.
And the Calpol, speaking of Calpol, you know that sort of injector thing that they give you? I extract water from the bath with it and then shoot it in my own face. And he finds that so funny.
I'm doing that gag too.
It's a great gag.
Have you ever tried squirting it into your mouth and then looking really worried and spitting it out?
I haven't tried that. Guess what I'm doing tonight at bath time?
He will love it.
He loves that. He likes things hitting him in the face as well. Okay. Soft things. He finds that very funny. And that's one thing that sort of caught me off guard is comedy in babies is a way that they learn. So I read this article, I think it was in The New Yorker, about how when they do something wrong, you make a sharp sound like a ah or a no or whatever. If they do something right, you go, well done, and you sort of applaud it. But if they do something a bit wrong, like holding a spoon the wrong way around or putting a bowl on their head or whatever, you might laugh. And then they go, oh, I've not done something as bad to get the sharp sound and I've not got applause, but I've got this other sound, which is, so I'm doing something a bit wrong, but it's not wrong enough for danger and all that. And so they're trying to make you laugh to learn the world. Oh. And I think that's what stand-up is. I think I'm going out and trying to work out, is this opinion or thought that I had bad enough that you stop laughing?
Yeah, yeah.
Or that you sort of applaud and it's all very virtue signaling? Or is it weird enough but relatable enough that you laugh? And I think in a more complicated way, not that complicated, just talking about cock and balls most of the time, but I think it's essentially the same thing, that we're just learning through comedy about the world.
Do you think that becoming a dad has, because it's given you this insight as an example, do you think it's made you a better comedian, or do you think it's taken away from your professional success?
It's like, hard to say at this point because yeah. I've only just sort of recently come back into it.
Yeah.
But it's definitely made me more risk averse. And I think comedy, inherent in comedy, is risk and saying things that you're not quite sure how it's going to go. And I definitely have retreated a lot and I'm worried about just the collateral damage of if I say the wrong thing or do something, a stunt goes wrong or whatever, that there are other people that will be affected now. So I think in the long term, it may have made me a worse comedian. But I wasn't that good anyway, so it's fine. You know, a drop in 10%, no one's going to notice. It's, you know, in the gutter anyway.
Is that part of why you're so protective about your family? Because some people, like me, I monetize everyone in the house. And with you, you were really good, I think, at carving out the difference between, like, this is me,
yes,
my stage persona, and this is my private life. And that's why people thought it was a prank.
Well, I would counter what you were saying about your family, because I think you've always been very protective of your family. And I think it's just my background is that my parents have never, and my sister have never wanted to be in the public eye. I always ask them when there's an opportunity for family to go on things, and they're always like, no. The only thing that mum and dad did was, who do you think you are? Because they felt that was an important thing to do. There's nobody, I don't think I ever met anyone famous until I was a sort of late teen or started doing stand-up. So there wasn't any of that in my life. So it is a weird thing to do. And that is one thing that I feel, is that if I was my age with the environment I have now and hadn't done stand-up, I wouldn't start now, because it is a mad thing to do and it's so high risk. So I sort of feel that for the Punisher, it's up to him if he wants to do that later and then be in the public eye, because there is an inherent risk in being in the public eye and being known and having your face known and all of that. And if I end up doing something appalling, he can change his surname and no one knows who he is, essentially. And with Denise, she just has a job where she works with vulnerable people, essentially. And so if people know that I'm with her or whatever, it might affect her work, essentially. So we just... and also she has no desire. It's weird to do what we do. There's something odd about it. It's desperate. It's pathetic. We should grow up and just get on with doing a proper job rather than sitting in Bauer Media talking about our health. Get a proper life. We both need proper lives.
But
here we are. We love the money. We love the adoration. But I do think it's up to them. It's up to the Punisher if he wants to be as mad as me in the future.
I don't think we want proper jobs, because I started stand-up older than you did. When I first met you, I think you were still a teenager.
I started 19.
Yeah, I met you so early, and you were so beautiful and full of life and so funny already. And I had lived. I'd had jobs. And I don't like them. And I think that...
Yeah, jobs are gross.
Jobs are gross. And this is fun, because without doing this job, I wouldn't have any friends at all. I don't know anyone outside my job and my immediate family.
Yeah.
I live far away from my parents and my sisters and my extended family. But one thing I've always admired about you, and this could contribute to a healthy cellular performance today,
right,
is that you seem to have always had a really rich social life. You have friends that I don't know, friends who've never appeared on QI.
Yeah.
You have groups, and you go to the pub with people, and you're invested in family. And I think that's really good. So is it purposeful that you prioritize rest and relaxation and socializing?
Yeah, I think so. I get a lot out of it. I really feel, and I'm sure lots of people have this, that I'm not in the coolest WhatsApp group. Do you know what I mean? I have this real sense that there's a big WhatsApp group, and I love all of my old school friends. I'm very fortunate I've got this WhatsApp group with loads of my old school friends. But I know there are subgroups, all the women have a group, and then slag off all of their partners, which I'd love to be in that group because I'm slagging them all off as well. And then there's like a few comedy WhatsApp groups, but not really. And then I hear about groups where I'd love to be in that group because they're lovely people. And I do feel that I have fingers in lots of pies, but I don't really nurture loads of friendships properly. Mm. Case in point, like we've been talking about like me popping around to see you, whatever, and it's just not happened because I'm lazy and I forget and all of this.
That would be the Punisher.
Well, and the Punisher is entirely his fault.
Once you have kids, you don't have friends.
Yeah, well, it has narrowed a lot of my social circle very naturally. But I do really cherish my friends, and I really sort of, I think about people and I go, I'd love to see them. Why haven't I seen them in ages? And then I look at the diary and I go, oh, well, I've got to go on QI, so I can't do it then. And, you know, I end up filling the diary, and I would love to spend more time with, I really miss my comedy pals. Yeah. And I think I love listening to this podcast because it's handy having famous friends because you can just listen to them on podcasts. That is useful. You can kind of keep up to date. But yeah, so, but it is important to me to have good relationships and good sort of friendships because it's sort of free therapy, isn't it, essentially? Like, it's my friend Adam, who I went for lockdown walks with and who lives in Birmingham, a local publican, and we just basically vented for the whole time on lovely rambling walks, and that's invaluable, really, and I think walking as well. I think when you're face-to-face with somebody, it changes the dynamic. When you're walking and looking around, I think that's so much better for getting your thoughts out and because you're not taking those micro-expressions and all those things. So.
And I don't know how you feel about gender stereotypes, but they do say that for men, they tell women who are in heteronormative relationships married to men like me, that if you want to speak to them, then you do have to be driving, or this is why men golf, or like you say, we're walking with Adam.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yes, I didn't know that. Yeah.
But you do.
I wonder what that is. Because women are taking in micro expressions as well, but are you just better at dealing with it?
We're better than men. Mm. But then I've always really liked you, and I like that you challenge those stereotypes and you bend them all the time. And I think that's another reason people thought it was a prank.
Yes.
Has anyone from the gay community reached out livid?
No.
Any LGBTQAI, queer person think that that whole thing was a prank or like a stage affectation?
Oh, what?
That you've just been like incredibly straight the whole time.
I think I worry that people feel like that. But actually the queer community don't care, basically. There's a lot. The whole point of the LGBT community is that you are what you are, and there's various versions of you throughout time and space. So I worry about it, that I sort of feel like I've turned my back on them a little bit. I never had relationships with men, so it's was attracted to and slept with a few over the years. My God. Same. The quality control was not good.
No.
My friend Lara said to me the other day, she said, when we were at school, you said, I think I'll end up with a woman, and I don't remember saying that, and she always remembered that. So I was bang on. I was bang on. My taste in men is so base. It's just like hot bod, ugly face, let's go.
Great.
And I don't think that's conducive for a long-term relationship. Whereas like my taste in women, I'm so much more interested in the presence of women, I suppose, and like the company of women and the minds of women. Whereas men, I do not care. You could remove the brain. I don't care. It's a physical thing of just like fit. And I just don't think that's sustainable.
Welcome to the heteronormative female experience. So yeah. Attitude Magazine have not threatened to take away your 7th hottest man in the world title.
No, but that was because I was hot and you not are? Because I'd skewed the vote by forcing my Twitter followers to vote for it.
Okay.
So that's, you know, that's democracy in action. Mm-hmm. They can't reverse that as much as they'd like to try.
Yeah.
Because Attitude famously are quite fascist. so no, they will never prize that from my cold, dead grip.
Okay. I'm going to ask you some quick fire questions. If you could be Joe Lycett at any age, past, present, or future, what age would you choose?
This is interesting. One thing that's happened since The Punisher was born is I've really got, I had a period of real nostalgia. And the bit that I wanted to go back to was lockdown. sort of like in the sort of early summer of lockdown, where it was like, it was a beautiful summer, if you remember. It was like just sunny. And I was on my own and I was grieving at the time. So I'd sort of like, I'd just wake up and I'd go, I'm going to do some gardening today. Then I'd open a bottle of wine at about one. And that was my day for about 3 months, essentially. And I remember like waking up, the Punisher had got me up about 5:30. And I just thought, that'd be so nice to just go back to there. But the Punisher was poorly recently, and we had to go into hospital and whatever. And I got that real sense of like, I would take any pain that you have 1,000 times over. I would bulldozer through a nursery to save you. Like, I would do whatever it takes. And I realized I don't want to go back to that point because he's not there. So it was a lovely time, but it's gone. So I do truly think now is the era I would like to be in. I don't think there's an era before. There's lots of times when I've had, you know, great experiences, but actually, if I was honest with myself, I was probably massively anxious and drinking my way through it. So right now, I think I've kind of, I do just think life gets easier and you understand yourself better as you go through it, basically. So I do have these little bursts of nostalgia, but it is mainly at 5:30 when he's woken me up.
Have you always been really good at living in the now?
No, I'm constantly somewhere else. So no, but where I am is normally not an actual thing that's happened. I'm normally in some sort of fantasy land that I've created in my brain. So I'm normally quite jolly because I've created some sort of weird egg-based character that's floating around. So I just live in this fantasy area that is definitely not the here and now. But you have to do that when you live in Birmingham.
Yes.
Because otherwise, it really does get you down.
And you're a creative genius because of it.
Well, you know, some would say that. Not anyone who understands art, I would say.
Definitely the owners of your paintings, like me.
Yes.
I have many books. I have a large, incredible girth pig painting.
You have the pig, yes.
Above my marital bed.
Yeah. I wonder if that's got anything to answer for.
Yeah, it can be intimidating.
Does it get the girthy pig?
Yeah.
Does it help in the bedroom, would you say?
Well, we have like 16 kids, so I guess.
You're welcome.
16 Punishers.
Yeah.
Going back to grief, do you want to talk about your friend who died from cancer in lockdown?
What a question.
Well, it's relevant to the test.
Yeah, yeah.
Because this is what I'm trying to get a picture of. You are such like a wonderful, aforementioned creative genius, happy-go-lucky, like really insightful parent now. But you said you had anxiety in the past, and then I know this grief triggered a lot of bad stuff for you, and that can be reflected in the test.
Well, basically, yeah, it was basically my best pal. He had Crohn's disease, which is a sort of bowel disease, and he's had it all his life. And it just got progressively worse and then turned into cancer. And I was around that demise a lot, basically. Mm-hmm. And when I think back to that time, no wonder I was sort of the relief of lockdown and kind of free space, because I was making a TV show. And then when there was any time when I wasn't making the TV show, I was with him, either in hospital or sort of at his bedside.
I remember you going up and down and back and forth a lot.
And that was just such a lot. And that was like when I did the Hugo Boss stunt, that was at the same time. And so I sort of was with him at the bedside and I was like, I've been asked to go on Victoria Derbyshire. And he was like, go. And I had to pretend to be Hugo Boss in Victoria Derbyshire. And then he said, like, there's just so many like plates in the air. But there was a lot of bodily fluid, for want of a better term, I suppose. And I was around a lot of vomit. And I then, after he died, developed this thing where I thought I was going to vomit pretty much at all times. And I couldn't go out for meals. I couldn't enjoy a pint. And I love pints. Pints are my favorite.
Yeah.
And I'm not even talking about beer. I just think it's a beautiful measurement. Like a pint of water in the morning.
Yeah.
Pint of lager. Like, I'm not really drinking that much at the minute. A Guinness Zero.
Mm.
It's a pint. It's a beautiful, creamy pint. Yeah. Lovely. Can still drive. Anyway, so I had this sort of anxiety thing. I'd go for a meal and I'd be sat there and I'd be like, I'm going to vomit now and that's going to ruin the meal. And I just become obsessed with that. And I would try and put something in my mouth and just was convinced it would just force a vomit. And so it really, and I love going out for dinner. I love all of these things. So it just really kind of narrowed my life. But I had some brilliant therapy. I had a thing called EMDR, which is an eye movement thing. Mm. And it's excellent, or at least it was for me. It really, really helped sort of process the trauma of what had happened. And I now get little flourishes of it normally when I'm tired, where I kind of go, oh, I can feel that anxiety happening, but I've got all the things in my kind of locker now to deal with it. So I, yeah, it doesn't happen anymore. And it's, I'm really grateful for that therapy. But I think I'm really grateful to have gone through all of it, because I think now anxiety doesn't worry me. Mm-hmm. And actually, if something makes me anxious, I think, oh, maybe I should run towards that. And generally, that is the way out of it for me, is to go, this thing terrifies me, let's do it twice. You know, yeah. I sort of think that's, there's a kind of control and power in that, which I really sort of relish. So I think having anxiety is a useful thing in life, and being able to cajole it and not be intimidated by it and just sitting in the uncomfort is something I've learned to do. Which is what kind of going back to what I was saying about the older I get, I don't go, oh God, I'll feel horrible in that situation, I won't do it. I go, so what? You'll feel horrible. Go and do it. Like, you'll learn something.
And it will never be as horrible as...
Never as horrible as you think it is.
No. And I think, I'm obviously very sorry, and I remember that time for you when your friend passed away. But I think sometimes when you have big things in your life, like the birth of the Punisher,
yes,
the loss of a close friend,
yeah,
even though you never want to lose someone, it's really centering. You go, oh, nothing matters. Especially when your son was born, it's like, oh, nothing matters. If he's safe and well, nothing matters. And I had that really early with Violet.
I've reflected on this as well about not just you, but my friends with kids. How has anyone done anything? Because for the first year, I took a year off and I was like, I don't know how anyone does anything, because it's so all-encompassing.
Yeah.
But now I'm sort of out that first year and he's starting to become like a person and I would happily have here wandering around, and that I kind of get that it gives you a freedom because, as you say, nothing matters. You kind of, as long as he's fine, you can do whatever gag you want to do or do, like, make decisions, whatever. So I think it explains your fearlessness to me, actually, that having Violet so young was, and going into comedy with Violet actually just gave you like a superpower.
Definitely. I just did not care that much about, you know, nerves, like pre-stage nerves or... Equally, everything mattered a lot. Like, I had to perform well. I had to generate an income.
Yes.
Because there was no one else going to do it. But ultimately, if she was safe and well, I just really didn't care.
But it also removes that. I definitely, as a father, write better. Mm-hmm. That's a terrible sentence, so I obviously don't. I write more productively. I'm more effective with the time that I have, because I've only got that time to write jokes. And if I don't write jokes that time, I don't have jokes. Whereas before him, I was just like, well, I'll write later. I'll have a glass of wine. All these things sort of, you kind of go, I write when I'm inspired. No, you've got to write now. This is all you've got. And I do think there's something in that, like, all of those sort of little voices, you can't listen to them, because you don't have time to listen to them. You've literally, the gig is tonight and you've got to write some jokes for it. So I do think it's made me more productive. But whether it's made me, I don't know, as I say, less ambitious with the kind of things that I would do, it's a bit too early to say, really. But I do feel that I feel a retreat happening slightly in the kind of work that I want to do. But I don't know, because I get fired up by stuff and I think, oh, that's wrong.
We'll
I sent a Freedom of Information request to Birmingham City Council yesterday, so I'm still going.
Good. We'll see, because sometimes you don't know what you're capable of until you're in it. You might think, oh, if I expose the family in it, but then again, like you say, you'll be motivated to write a Freedom of Information letter to Birmingham City Council.
Yes.
Can you give us an inside scoop of, like, the subject?
Yeah. So when mentioned the Punisher was ill, so I drove to A&E, Birmingham Children's Hospital, parked up, took a little picture of the Ringo number, but didn't immediately go like, oh, well, let's just wait while my son is unwell to just do the Ringo thing. I thought, I'll do it when I get in there. Yeah. And he was being assessed, and I was paying for parking whilst he's being assessed. So I was like one eye on him, and then... And when, for whatever reason, there must have been a parking attendant like floating around that area.
Especially when he sees you come in.
Well, exactly.
He knows.
So slapped the minute, and it's the same minute that I got the parking fine. So I got a parking fine. And I thought, they must be making so much money from people rushing into A&E, not paying for parking straight away or whatever. And I think that's morally wrong. Mm-hmm. There's an argument for hospitals having car parks if the hospital takes the revenue, which often they don't, because it ends up going to Q Park or whoever. But for Birmingham City Council to just make revenue from parents that are rushing their kids into A&E, I think is morally wrong. Mm-hmm. So I've put a Freedom of Information request in to ask them for the last three financial years of revenue from that street and all the neighbouring streets. And I've listed the streets and the coordinates. I know what I'm doing with the FOI. And I want to know exactly how much money they've made. And even if it's £100, I want them to donate it to the Birmingham Children's Hospital Trust. Because I think that is morally wrong.
See, that's
nice, I mean, they are bankrupt and they're not emptying the bins or whatever.
That is nice, Joe.
I've got a lot of time for Birmingham City Council. I've made friends with a lot of Lord Mayors there. You know, I think we're a struggling city and I've got some patience for them, but not for that.
No.
I think hospital car parks, weird thing, isn't it? Imagine driving around being a billionaire or multimillionaire and you go, how did you make that money? Well, I charged dying people to park.
You know that road by the A&E entrance?
Yes.
That's me.
That's how I made my cash. And I feel good about it.
You know, it wouldn't be likable coming from anyone else to hear the phrase, I know my way around an FOI. But from you, how did you get into stuff like that? Because obviously I know you, first and foremost, as a very funny stand-up and a wonderful man. But I think the general public, like you really broke through mainstream with this David Beckham shredding money prank.
Yeah, yes.
And what would you say were like the big elevating pranks that people really started to know you for?
Hugo Boss one was quite a big one.
That was so scary because I was with you in the Hugo Boss store.
Yeah.
So what was our task? We had to put your products on the Hugo Boss shelves.
You were so, as you always are, like so cool and calm and just like doing the job that you'd been asked to do, which was to put, we'd created a wrist support that we were putting on the shelves at Hugo Boss, and then having, we had our own product launch at Hugo Boss.
Yeah.
So to give some context, there's a brewery in Swansea called Boss Brewing, and they received a very stern letter from Hugo Boss's lawyers saying that they had to stop trading with the name Boss because there would be confusion around the product lines, because obviously the Boss fragrance is very similar to a can of beer. It basically crippled this business, cost them thousands of pounds. And we were in the office, I was making a show about consumer stuff, so it was one of the stories on the show. And I was thinking, like, what is the story here? Like, what's the issue? And basically, they don't like people using their name. And I thought, well, they can't legally stop me changing my name by deed poll. So I changed my name to Hugo Boss. And then just made statements as Hugo Boss, because that's my name. I can say whatever I like. And they had to issue a statement and they tried to make it funny, but obviously they're all sat in black turtlenecks and there's not a laugh amongst them. And
I didn't know they were trying to make that statement funny.
Yeah, I mean, maybe they weren't, I don't know.
It wasn't funny.
They were trying to be like light.
Yeah.
And
they can't match the humor.
They're still going.
The real Hugo Boss.
Yeah, well, exactly. They're still pushing out. People message me from time to time. I think there's a Scouse something Boss, because they love the word Boss in Liverpool. There's a few Scouse businesses that have been caught out by their lawyers. But my guess is that they have a lawyer just waiting to go, who's like scouring the internet, trying to make some money, basically to go, please, Hugo Boss, CEO, I've made some more legal money. It's pathetic.
You're not the boss,
That's not a proper job either.
No.
I don't know what a proper job is. I do have a list of things that he can't be, the Punisher.
Okay.
Improviser. No.
Valid.
Stand-up, I think, no. We can negotiate. Anything in finance. I think our plan really is to hobble him at some stage so he can't leave.
Fine.
I think that's... Is that acceptable parenting?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think there's some real unacceptable parenting out there nowadays.
Yeah.
That being trapped with you sounds like
I'm
a good
nice
time.
I'm a nice guy.
Yeah.
I'm a fighter. I'll just
Punisher.
Fight him for the rest of his life.
Do you think you'll have more?
I don't think it's off the cards.
No.
Because I'm incredibly fertile.
Yeah.
So it could happen. Could happen at any point to to anyone.
So I felt anxiety being part of a small part of your Hugo Boss launch.
Yeah.
How do you go into pranks like this that are so visible and you're fighting against councils and lawyers and whomever else? How do you do that without anxiety or do you just manage
and
it?
And it's cringe as well, isn't it? It's really horrible doing stuff where like you're being weird in the public. The first one we did was I took a Portaloo to Euston Station because they were charging to use the toilet. Yeah. So I was offering a free toilet to Euston travellers. And I remember really enjoying that, but also feeling like if I passed somebody doing this, I'd be like, grow up. Like it's a horrible, I don't know, it's something a bit weird about it. But I think I just sort of, again, just went, oh, well, like it's for a greater thing.
Yeah.
And ultimately they did, you know, you don't have to pay to go to the toilet at Euston anymore or any train station. Yeah, but there have been a few where I've come sort of finished the shoot and thought there's like an iron taste in the mouth where you go, oh, I don't know if I kind of upset that person or whatever. But we always had a rule that like we never showed receptionists or people in who worked for the company in Vision. We always blurred them and changed their voices so that it was never about them. It was always about the people at the top of the company who were making the decisions. Yeah. So I think we was kind as we could be to those people.
I think in reckless hands, some of these pranks could have been mishandled, could have been mean-spirited, but I think the reason why people embrace them so much and you don't have to worry that it's cringe is that you execute all the pranks really beautifully with the right intention.
Well, I think that's it, isn't it? It's like the intention is the key thing. And I sort of don't like the word prank because it's sort of, I know prank feels like you're pulling someone's trousers down and it's not that.
Have you considered pulling someone's trousers down?
Yeah. Given half a chance.
Was the David Beckham one scary? Because that was that arguably the most high profile?
Yes, definitely. Because that was sort of global news. I think CNN ran that.
Mm-hmm.
And that was scary because you're taking on a nation state, essentially. And also a sort of national treasure. So it's high stakes. I sort of, the analogy I have with that is that I felt like a bit of a bee and I put my sting in and part of me was sort of removed when I finished that because I was definitely sort of a bit sort of scarred by the filming of the shredding of the money is one of the sort of hardest filming days I've ever done. And I knew that I wasn't actually shredding money and whatever, but it just felt big and it felt, I don't know, it felt like something was happening. And then it sort of took on this other life. And I know that lots of the gays, Fat Tony is, DJ Fat Tony is a glorious person. And he sort of talked to me about the sort of behind the scenes stuff there in terms of, I mean, he chats as we know. And so I was quite reassured when I met him because he was like, you know, behind the scenes, a lot of the gays were rooting for you, even if they couldn't say publicly. Mm-hmm. So that was, a good thing. All that world, you know, I don't really mix with like uber celebs. I don't think I ever do. Maybe Robbie Williams is a bit of an uber celeb and he's become a bit of a pal. But other than that, I don't really.
How are you friends with Robbie Williams?
He messaged me. What your painting is inspired, it's a sort of work with Robbie Williams. Yeah. He messaged me about my art and wanted to talk about making some art together. Uh-huh. And that is actually the painting you have is the one that we ended up doing together. And then I thought he was very sweet and lovely. But I've now realised that he loves comedians. So he rang James Acaster to talk about stuff recently. And
he hasn't called me. And I'm in a film with his child.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, well,
not interested.
I'll swap numbers and whatever. So.
Maybe anyway. He doesn't know I'm a comedian. He thinks I'm a dramatic actress.
Uber celebs are a different world, aren't they, basically? And
Are they or are they not? Because it depends. Like, if you connect with them and you can be on a level where you have a gorilla, whatever you want to call it, like that.
Yes. I suppose what it does is it sort of exposed me to, I sort of started to realize, like the press. Because I'm not really in the press. I'm not, you know, people don't really care about what I do, apart from when The Punisher was born. So I'm not really like written, I'm not normally in the sidebar on the Daily Mail or whatever.
Isn't that funny? But, as an aside, you've done these huge things, big shows, comedy specials, you're all over telly, and you say people don't really care about what I do, apart from when The Punisher was born. Something everyone does.
Yeah.
It's like have a baby.
Yes.
And that's when
that's
you
the
felt
thing that they were interested
you
in,
were tabloid fodder.
Yeah, I was. And like Paps following us to nurseries and stuff was just a very odd experience and not something that I want to recreate, really.
And then did you have Paps when this, and like refresh for listeners who don't know the David Beckham.
So David Beckham, when the Qatari World Cup was happening, which was a dubious place to hold the World Cup anyway, as was well reported from a football point of view, because it's, you know, they had to change the Premier League schedule. Mm-hmm. Who would do such a thing? Mm-hmm. He took a substantial amount of money from the Qatari government to promote Qatar and did various adverts for them, whatever. And I wanted essentially to raise the profile of the human rights of Qatari queer people, which at the time, I've not done the research recently, so I don't know, but at the time were pretty appalling. And again, when we looked at that story, we talked about going to Qatar and trying to do a pride event, because Qatar were basically saying like...
Jeez, what?
Yeah.
Whose idea was that? Thank you for that.
It was mine, actually. I think it was mine.
I'm glad you didn't do that.
Think of all these ways of like making that, like making it sort of...
Impactful.
And then Beckham basically gave us that way in because he had done this big advert. And I also thought that he wants to do the right thing, I think. You know, he does a lot of good things for the country and for humanities. He, you know, does a lot of things for charity. And I thought, if I have any power, it's to persuade him. The Qatari government don't give a shit about me, but they might give a shit if he, you know. So I thought putting the pressure on him as a sort of mule would be my way of being most effective. That was it, really. But he sort of, he kind of stuck to what he was doing. And
you said, if you don't step down, I'll shred this money?
Yes. So what I said is, if you don't sort of, step down, then I will shred £10,000, I think it was.
And already it became a big news story before the shredding.
Yes, well, because there was a countdown and then you're waiting for his response and all that. So, like, I knew that the press would go, oh, fuck, great, lovely. There's something really intimidating about, like, at this date, I'm going to do this thing.
It was a little, like, bit Despicable Me. Like,
It was like, and it was fascinating watching it. And I loved it, yeah. But I think it was just, it was so all-consuming and suddenly there was just so many different things, and irons in the fire. And
was then, there a moment when the panic struck or... Like,
it was filming the shredding. I was just like, oh, shit. Like,
so you hadn't pre-filmed the shredding?
No, we pre-filmed it to then go out when we said it was going to happen.
Basically. Okay.
But as I say, it wasn't real money, and I donated the money to LGBT charities, LGBT people getting into sport. So there was that amount of money that was ready to go, but it didn't get shredded. Then afterwards... I'd talked about this openly because, you know, my gig list is a public thing and I've written about it, that I had gigged in Qatar and the Sun newspaper decided to say that I was a hypocrite as a result of that. But my argument was and has always been that doing gigs in these places, fine, I think, you know, if there's an audience that want to go and see you do stand-up somewhere, fine, because... they're a paying audience and I think stand-up and the arts should be shared with everyone. To do a job for the government of those is a very different thing. And it'd be weird for me to do a gig for Keir Starmer, I think. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's an odd thing to perform for the king. Yeah. So my argument was very much about, like, this is what the government of this country does. Yeah. The people are a very different thing. But obviously the Sun like to spin things as they do. And... So then I got caught up in all that and like having to put a statement out and whatever. And I was just annoyed because I normally think through all of the things that could happen. Mm. And it would have been a simple fix in our script to say all of that in our script in the TV show, but we didn't. And then the Sun sort of went, well, he didn't mention it. He must have been. And, like, you know, it's just annoying.
Yeah.
Because I'd planned it so beautifully. But,
well, I don't think most people saw the Sun's repulsed of like...
No, I suppose their circulation is a little low these days.
But I think people cared about that moment and the countdown, like you said, what was the gap between releasing the Shredding the Money video and revealing that you hadn't actually shredded money?
It was only like 24, 48 hours, something like that.
It's still a long time for people to be upset and say, he shredded this money, he should have.
Yeah.
But you sat on that information for two days.
And I was front page of some papers and and I was still doing other bits and bobs and was wandering around and I did feel my safety was potentially a little bit compromised at that point. So, yeah, as I say, like, I came away being like, I've really got close to danger there in a way that I didn't like. So I'm not sure I'd do a big stunt like that again.
Are you glad you did it, though?
Really glad I did it and really glad I made that point. And I'm really proud of all of the stuff we did on Joe Lycett's Got Your Back and mm-hmm. all of those campaigns. But because also I like to think we made them funny. Like they were funny. They had gags throughout all of them. But yeah, it's a different era for me now.
And then quickly, I didn't even know this, as your good friend, you nearly got arrested for the donkey dick joke.
Yeah. Well, it's not a donkey dick joke.
It's a joke about you being a young man helicoptering your penis.
Yes.
And to avoid publishing images of child abuse.
Sort of, yeah.
You put a donkey's dick on top of your dick. And then someone in Belfast called the police.
Sort of, yeah. Yeah.
Because they wanted to see your real dick. I don't remember it. It's on the cards. I do not remember this happening to you.
I had a routine in my stand-up show, which I still defend as one of the funniest things I've done. So it was a routine about being camp and how people have always said that I was camp and I was camp as a child. And I found this footage of me as a child being very camp. And I wanted to show it, but I'm naked in it. And I was told by a lawyer that you can't show a naked child in your show. And I was like, but I'm the child, I don't mind. Mm. And they're like, no, you just can't do it. You can't show a child's penis. And I was like, okay, can you show an adult's penis? And they said, yeah, that's fine. So I paid an animator to put an adult penis over my child's penis, blurred it. But like, there's basically, it's me as a kid with a huge donkey dick flapping around. And it is, they did a beautiful job on it.
You don't understand pedophiles at all.
No. No, I hope not. And so, and I'd played to so many gigs and I'd showed this footage to so many, people, it was done well, as well as putting a child, massive cock on a child, could be done well. And I played in Belfast and as I understand it, a off-duty police officer was there and felt that what had happened was a disgrace and went back. And I was called by my management the next morning to say, the police would like to come to the show tonight to observe what you're doing. And I was like, can I film their reaction to what I'm doing? They were like, no, they're not going to come to the show. Can you just send what the footage is? And so I sent the footage over. And then there was this sort of kind of empty time where I was wandering around Belfast having a lunch, potentially my last lunch before I go behind bars, and then got the call to say that no crime had been committed and I was free to go. But it was a bit choppy for a while.
This is what is wonderful about getting older, is that I think what we both have in common, and there is like chagrin mixed into it all. We used to have so much fun and all of us were like out there and young and, you know, doing whatever we were doing that might not be appropriate now. Is arguable, but it was then and it was fun then and we did it. And the fact that we did it means we can be where we are now.
Yeah.
And have little punishers and a real proper serious family life.
Yeah.
And peace and art.
The one thing I want to encourage in him and all people really is that you should have a go at all of it. Like if you're even half curious about trying something, try it and get it wrong and embarrass yourself, because I really got into stand-up because I got pissed at a show that I was an audience member at. Then the compere said, does anyone in the audience want to give it a go? And I thought I could do better, and I absolutely couldn't. And humiliated myself in front of my friends that were there, the whole audience. And that was a great motivator for me to go, no, I actually can do this. And I'm going to, and here we are 20 years later, and I can't, but I tried. I really tried. Uncomfortable situations, anxiety, being in situations where you look like an idiot and you've made a complete twat of yourself, are all really important things to do and to learn. But that's why I sort of don't want him to be in the public eye until he's decided to, because if I sort of film him and put him on my Instagram,
yeah,
and he's acting an idiot or whatever, it's not a level playing field.
Yeah.
I mean, life isn't a level playing field anyway, and he's, you know, essentially a Nepo baby, but we're going to go full Bradley Walsh with him when I'm older and just going to do a game show. And
he's not a Nepo baby if you don't allow it.
Yeah, that's true.
Let him fly.
Maybe I'll pretend I'm something else. What job should I say that I am? I'm a carpenter. I've worked for years as a carpenter. I've made this beautiful thing.
Well, you could be a gardener. I want to talk to you about the garden because I think it is super relevant. In your questionnaire, you said you eat over 30 plants a week, which Nicola, who you are about to meet, goes on and on about how great that is. Are you and the family and the Punisher, are you eating fruit and veg from your own garden?
Yes. So even in the winter, I've got winter lettuce, not lettuce, some like rocket and spinach and stuff that I grow in the greenhouse.
Incredible.
I've got a thing that is it's like a hydroponics basically. Mm-hmm. And I managed to get tomatoes out of it in like January. I'm trying to do tomatoes at the minute, it's not really working. But yeah, basically I try and grow a lot that we can eat. And the sweet corn you get out of the garden is just unbelievable. And you start to realize, oh, all the stuff that's in the supermarket is just complete dross. That there's something about carrots and all these things that when you grow them yourself, there's something magic in it.
Has that been harder with the Punisher, or you just involve him?
I involve him. Like last summer, I would just take him out and I'd let him touch things and sort of see what they all felt like and pick leaves from things. And we don't have anything, I don't think, that's particularly toxic in the garden. So just let him eat a bit of a leaf and see what happens and all that.
His microbiome must be just...
God.
See, yeah. This is what we need to do. This is an actionable takeaway, I think, that I have wanted for a long time to start gardening, but it just seems like a lot of work. We do have animals. Like, how do you keep animals off of it?
Well, they...
Well, you don't. Sometimes you post photos.
Yeah, and also, if they're, you know, if the dog's shitting on the border's great. Lovely. You know, mix it in. What you don't have to do... There's two things I'd recommend. One is just grow something in a pot that's really easy, like lettuce or salad, because you literally chuck the seeds in, put some soil over the top. It doesn't need to be particularly good soil, just like wherever. Just like do a shit and put it in there and water it when you remember. And then you'll just eat your own salad.
Well, I'm not allowed in the garden. Like, I don't think Bobby would support this.
Yes.
But maybe when he's away one day, I'll just get someone. Because I did try, and I was admonished in lockdown. I said, I'm going to start gardening. And I planted a few things. And then some people got upset. And they said, you think you can just garden? I am a horticulturalist. And you can't. Like some angry person on socials.
Oh,
and then
you've got to delete those apps.
You've previously described yourself as horny, tired, and pissy.
Yeah.
So if you could summarize how you feel about discovering your biological age in three words.
I think I'm two of those three right now. I'm not horny, but I need a piss and I'm tired.
All right. I'm sorry that I wasn't able to arouse you in this interview. It's a slam.
Do you know what? I am horny. I'm all three.
Good.
Basically, I thought I could say I'm all three and then it would seem inappropriate to be horny. And now I realize it was inappropriate to not be horny. I'm horny.
Good. Great.
What was the question?
How do you feel about the imminent reveal of your biological age?
I feel good about it, yeah. I think. I think I'm about bang on. I'm 37 and I think I'm about 37. I think I love pints, as I've made clear. Yeah. But I also exercise a fair whack and I eat lots of plants and I move a lot. And I think I've got a sort of healthy attitude to anxiety and all these things.
You're fighting a toddler nightly.
I'm fighting toddlers. I think I'm good.
All right. You've said in the past you feel old. Do you mean that you're an old soul or?
Yeah. Elderly woman.
Elderly woman.
I have the life views and approach to life of an elderly woman, I would say. But if that elderly woman lived in a 37-year-old male body.
The dream. All right. Well, I think that it's time to welcome Dr. Nicola Conlon and reveal the results of Joe Lice's biological age.
Uh-oh.
Joe, please join me in welcoming Dr. Nicola Conlon, a science
Hello.
Woman.
Hello.
I'm a bit starstruck because I've listened to this podcast, mm-hmm. as I've made very clear, abundantly clear, and I'm intimidated by you and frightened.
It's time to reveal your biological age. Joe, chronologically, you are 37 years old. Your biological age is 30.
Oh, it isn't a cake. That's good. What is the cake? I'm more interested in the cake than the 30 right now.
It's a vanilla sponge.
How many plants are in it?
None.
That's great. Can I eat it?
You may.
Absolutely.
To celebrate? Oh, it's good.
Yeah. Mm. 30 is a very good result. How do you feel?
I feel 30, actually. No, I thought it would be higher, but not like crazy high.
Yeah.
But I thought I would be higher than my actual age. I'm spitting out cake now. So that's good news, I think. Mm-hmm. I'd be curious to know what I'm doing. I guess the plant thing is helping, but could I get myself down to 4? Is that doable?
You can get as low as 20, but that's as far as you can get with this test.
Right.
Feasibly, yes, you could go younger. But actually, when you're saying about what it is that you're doing well, you actually had a really interesting pattern. And I know you've listened to this podcast before, so we'll go a little bit deeper on the science, maybe than we usually do. But when we're measuring, we're looking at something called glycans, which are like little sugar molecules that are on your immune cells. And not like quite that type of sugar, different type of sugar, but we look at different ones. Mm. And one of them that we look at is called glycan youth. And this is something that if you have a young biological age or you are young, you have a lot of these ones. The other one is mature. And if you're older, you'll have a lot. Or if you've got a high biological age, you've got a lot. So what we saw in your results is that you have a lot of youth and not many mature, which is exactly what we want to see.
That's really good.
The really interesting bit for us was, which was actually quite rare, is we measure another one called glycan shield. And usually the people that get really good youth and mature also have a really high shield because it's just something that is kind of natural. They've got good natural immunity, low inflammation. But you didn't actually have that. You actually had fairly low. And this is a really unusual result. And from all of the testing that we have done, we've only ever seen it in a couple of people. And these were some quite famous life coaches and mindset coaches.
Oh, no.
And motivational speakers.
I hate them. Are you talking about, what's his name, Tony what's it?
Tony Robbins.
God, am I Tony Robbins?
No. So I can't say who it was, but this person is somebody, you know, is very in terms of having a good mindset, a positive outlook on life. And I think that from what I've heard from this conversation so far is something that you do have. You know, you're quite optimistic. You said earlier, I wrote it down, that you're okay with sitting in the uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important because this does measure inflammation, it measures stress. And sometimes stress isn't the problem, it's how we react to it.
Yes.
You know, if we're constantly getting stressed out by everything, your cortisol's high, your inflammation's high, but you're
quite going to be like a lifestyle influence now. Is that essentially my...
Yeah, you got permission.
Oh, that's exciting. Because Tony Robbins has a lot of money.
Yeah.
I could do a big conference in a center and charge people £300. I could do that.
But instead you took a year off to fight a baby.
Yeah. I did. I feel like I've never been depressed. Mm-hmm. I've had anxiety, but I think I'd know if I'd been depressed. I do generally sort of go, oh, a new day. What should we do with it? Yeah. I don't go, oh God, another day. Yeah. So if I was to not have that for whatever reason, then I would start to see the fact that I don't have many shields, essentially, and that would start to reduce by...
So we normally see shield in people that have a type of lifestyle where they're, like, doing everything right. So their diet, their sleep, their stress, everything is basically on. point,
yeah.
or they just naturally have that resilience. So I know we've had some guests where we look at their lifestyle and we're like, oh, you know, it's a
we're
surprise
talking about Joanne McNally.
That yeah. their memories came back so well, yeah. but they have this phenomenally high shield. But what it shows for you is that you don't actually have that sort of natural protection.
Yeah.
It's more that mindset, I think, from that pattern. Like I say, we've only ever saw it in this type of person. So I think it's really having that mental resilience and also just that fun kind of carefree, like...
He's silly. He ate the cake. Silly,
yeah.
And I now feel unwell, actually.
But just
I got rid of the zero, so now I'm actually three, which is... my mind feels about three at the moment.
Did anything bad ever happen when you were really little that gave you just this perspective? Were you always this way? Or did just maybe really good things happen? Because I've met your parents.
Dave and Helen are just the yeah. most loveliest, sensible people. Really creative. And I do think they just set me up really well. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really helped. I sort of feel like I've just sort of lucked out with lots of things. And I think my mindset, I don't feel like I've had a choice in my mindset. It's just what it is. And I'm very grateful to that.
When I was doing some research, I came across this really interesting study, and it was actually about laughter. And I never realized this is a proper clinical study, that laughing actually improves your immune system. Mm-hmm. And it was like a fully controlled, published study. And they showed people films and funny ones, basically measured the blood afterwards yeah. and showed that it improved the immune cells. So, yeah, so laughing every day.
Now, that's interesting because Denise makes me laugh every day. Mm-hmm. She's so funny. That's really interesting and yeah. makes sort of sense, but...
Yeah.
Yeah, so...
We're basically doctors.
I think so.
Going out there, dishing out our prescriptions.
It seems, Joe, like all along, we have had proper jobs.
Yes.
Wow, what a discovery.
Yeah.
Well, thanks so much. I'm 3 years old, and like a 3 year old, I'm going to shove my face into a cake.
That was your friend and mine, comedian Joe Lycett, up to undoubtedly another gorilla prank for us all to enjoy. Also, I happen to know he's doing a great big show. Maybe you know about it now, maybe you don't. We haven't talked about it, but he's in your living rooms a lot. And now we know a little bit more. If you want to be healthy and beautiful and happy like Joe, plant a garden, be silly, and have a baby with someone called Denise. Thank you for listening to What's My Age Again. Please like and subscribe and check us out next time wherever you get your podcasts.
This was a Rayo Original Podcast. Rayo.